risk. And we are also looking at issues of shadow banking, like the risk that is contained by the hedge fund sector and money market funds. We are also looking at proper supervision of CRAs. First, we thought that CRAs were much too rosy in their examinations of risk. Now we think, as they are starting to downgrade governments, we think that they might not be a bit too pessimistic every now and then. But there's a lot to talk about. And as if the risk identified by Professor Golden is not enough, I would like to add two more things that we might have on our plate or should have on our plate, which up to now I don't think we have paid enough attention to. Given the fact that the financial crisis to a large extent originated in conduct of business problems, such as the problems in the securitization market and the problems in the mortgage markets, I think that we are not paying enough attention to conduct of business issues in the professional markets. Even now, you can hear investment banks say that they feel almost no responsibilities towards their customers when they act as market maker, when they are in between parties, even when they are fully aware that the product being sold is very deficient, not to use more ugly words. And the total collapse of underwriting standards during the crisis or preceding the crisis, I think it has not had enough attention. And secondly, I would like to say something about the enforcement of accounting standards. You will understand that I find that very important. What I think is so curious that whereas we as securities regulators are responsible for enforcement, strict enforcement of the private accounting standards in the private sector, that governments can more or less do what they want. Greece was, of course, a very extreme example of how things can go wrong with public accounting, but almost every government in the world has very sloppy accounting standards, does not take trillions of pension liabilities on the balance sheet, and I think that the investor in government securities is just as much entitled to investor protection as the investor in private bonds in the private market. And I think we still have a lot to do there, especially now when we are on the stage of the economic crisis, that the economic crisis is starting to hit the governments and is leading to, or might lead to, defaulting governments. This in the way of introduction on my part. Indeed, we do not yet have enough on our plate, I think. And I hope that we can discuss a couple of these issues with our panelists. We have four excellent panelists here. I wanted to say at the table, but the table is not there. First of all, I would like to introduce Mario Albert. He has recently been appointed president and CEO of the Quebec Autorité des Marchés Financiers. So a long time ago that I spoke French. He's also chair of our audit committee, and Quebec has been has undertaken a very prominent and leading role in the startup of our systemic risk work at IOSCO, for which we are very grateful. Verena Ross has been director of the UK's FSA International Division since 2009. And will soon be the first ever executive director of the new ESMA, the European Securities and Markets Authority. Then we have Seyla Pazarbasholu, more or less, from the IMF, assistant director in the Monetary and Capital Markets Department at the IMF, and she is in charge of the work on financial market regulation and supervision and crisis management. Then, last but certainly not least, my good friend Masa Kono, who has been Vice Commissioner for International Affairs at the Japan Financial Service Agency since 2009 and has just been appointed Chair of the Technical Committee. And Massa has promised to be very provocative this afternoon, so if he promises something like that, you better beware. Mario, can I ask you, what we'll try to do is brief introductions by everybody, 8, maximum 10 minutes, and I will be brutal again. Then we'll have a short discussion among ourselves and open it up to the public. Please, Mario.
Well, thank you, Hans. To kickstart the discussion, what I'd like to do is to briefly summarize some of the findings of the report prepared by the IOSCO Working Group on Systemic Risk. I guess by now, most of you will know the context in which this report was prepared. Then I'll be fairly brief on giving you the context. It also started back in, in April 2009. Then in the aftermath of the financial crisis, the G7 leader recommend that regulatory frameworks be reinforced in order to promote a system-wide approach to financial regulation, as well as to mitigate systemic risk. One of the many IOSCO respond to this concern has been to create a working group on systemic risks. As Hans mentioned, this group was co-chaired by two Canadian regulators, the Autorité des marchés financiers, as well as the Ontario Securities Commission. It also involved the participation of 13 other jurisdictions, so it was a major effort. For your information, the report was tabled to the FSB and was released last February. It is available on the IOSCO website. I don't have any advice to give, but I think it's an excellent bedtime reading for a securities regulator. The objective of the report, in line with the G7, the G20 requirement, the mandate of the working group was to provide insight on how IOSCO and securities regulator can identify, mitigate, and manage systemic risk. So it's a fairly wide mandate. Given that IOSCO members have a wide range of regulatory models, the work aimed at providing principle, you don't find in the report prescriptive requirement in terms of managing systemic risk. What you find is, broad orientation that can be applied to all kinds of different regulatory models. This being said, as Hans just mentioned, I have 10 minutes to summarize the report. It's a very long and sophisticated report, so I will basically focus on three issues. First, the role of a securities regulator with respect to systemic risk. One of the key messages of the report is that systemic risk must be a concern for security regulator. This might seem an obvious conclusion today. I must say it was not an obvious conclusion 3 or 4 years ago. Prior to the financial crisis, central bank and prudential regulator were the focal point for the stability of the financial system. Securities regulator in most jurisdictions felt that they were not responsible for evaluating systemic risk as part of their mandate. Indeed, traditional disclosure and business conduct function of securities regulator were contributing to the reduction of systemic risk. However, that was the impact was only indirect. That was not the goal of a regulator. Well, I think it's fair to say that this lack of focus had serious consequences and contributed to exacerbate the financial crisis. As we know now, it led to a misunderstanding of the risk in the system. It's also led to inadequate application of the tool available to securities regulator to limit undesirable risk-taking. Activities that had a significant impact on economic incentive and the flow of information were simply not regulated in many jurisdictions. To give you an example of that, we all know about the implication for credit rating agencies that were largely absent prior to, whose regulation was largely absent prior to the crisis. Prior to the financial crisis, a number of other elements having an impact on financial stability were not sufficiently supervised. For example, the activities of non-bank financial institutions, as well as the risk associated with OTC market. I would say, I think it's fair to say now that it's better understood that due to the global nature of modern financial market, it is important for securities regulator to identify and mitigate systemic risk. A second issue raised in the paper is how, in practice, securities regulator can mitigate systemic risk and promote financial stability. I think, and we all know, and we must not underestimate the fact that securities regulator have many tools they can use to address systemic risk issue. And I would like to highlight some of those tools in order to see the implication and how securities regulator can intervene and contribute to the mitigation of systemic risk. First, I would talk about the what we should call the traditional policy and regulatory tools of securities regulator. I think you know most of them. Disclosure and transparency is the first one. Those two elements are critical to identifying the development of systemic risk and to providing the regulators with the information needed to take action. For example, the use of trade repositories for derivative contract had it been better understood at the time of the financial crisis would have likely allowed regulator and market participants to have a better understanding of the risk and probably would have contributed to mitigate the risk associated. A second element is business conduct oversight. As you know, business conduct oversight is essential to managing conflict of interest and the buildup of undesirable incentive structure within the financial system. Going back again to the recent financial crisis, it can again be argued that more active monitoring of business model by securities regulator might have alerted them of growing problems in a number of financial institutions. A third tool available, or traditional tool available to a regulator, are organizational, prudential, and governance requirements. These provide incentive to market participants to better manage risk. As you know, better governance practice, including a principle for compensation, fall into this category. Again, it could be argued that in the last crisis, having remuneration aligned more closely with risk management would have encouraged a more accurate pricing of risk. Another tool available is the prevention of risk transmission. This includes all measures that can contribute to reduce the risk of contagion. For example, the use of central counterparties and trade repositories can achieve that goal. They can reduce counterparty exposure. They help market participants and regulator to better identify the buildup of risk in the derivative market. Finally, securities regulator can use emergency power. Obviously, it's a tool of last resort in the event of market disruption that could develop into a major shock. Regulators can temporarily suspend or restrict certain market activity, such as short selling. Beyond those traditional tools, market regulator can do other things like raising awareness. Securities regulator can raise awareness of other regulators about systemic risk arising from or passing through securities market. By communicating their concern, they can help initiate action from other regulators or when needed from legislator. And it's probably an important item at this point, as you know, to implement the reforms that are needed in many jurisdictions, legislative change are needed. Obviously, another element is financial innovation. The recent crisis was associated with a range of financial innovation. For example, CDO, CDS, all those elements contribute to deepen the crisis. Greater attention must be given by regulators to those innovations. This will require additional resources as well as close collaborations between regulators, given their various potential impact and the transfer of risk they often imply. Finally, I think that the regulator need to look carefully at the perimeter of security regulation. Securities regulators should periodically review the regulatory coverage of financing activities to ensure that none are escaping appropriate regulation. This being said, managing or mitigating systemic risk for a regulator is a major undertaking. In the future, in order to achieve that goal, it will be a challenge for regulators. First, as we know, systemic risks are here to stay. It's not something that will disappear in a couple of years. It must become an ongoing concern for a regulator. Each regulator will need to determine its own response in relation to its mandate, regulatory structure, and market characteristic. Addressing systemic risk will require most regulators to make structural, human, and financial resource commitment to deal with these issues. In order to be efficient, they will need to evaluate the scale of their response and the extent to which they can leverage rather than duplicate the work of others. Increased collaboration will be essential. Obviously, I cannot speak for other regulators, but in my organization in Quebec, this will require to operate a significant cultural change. The staff will have to broaden their horizon and become aware of systemic risk. Different professional profiles, like economists and financial experts, will be required. This being said, I'm finished. So this new focus on financial system stability will also require enhanced information and data for regulator and better surveillance system. So basically, the task of a regulator to identify and mitigate systemic risk will be a challenge. Considerable resource will have to be devoted to that. And I think that, again, it will be a major challenge for regulator to achieve that goal.
Thank you very much, Mario, for this very general and useful overview of all the problems and challenges that we are facing as regulators. I think you were quite right to point out the need for cultural change, which we have to undergo as securities regulators, because it was simply not on our horizon before. Verena, can I ask you to take the floor?
Sure, thank you. I wanted to touch on two topics today. One was to talk a bit about the articulation of the concept of systemic risk, following on from Mario's comments, and actually reflecting, I think, very similar thoughts on that. So I'll cut that quite short, and then talk about some of the practical measures that we might be needing to take to identify, monitor, and ultimately mitigate some of the systemic risks, and particularly talk about some of the work that IOSCO has recently done on surveying hedge funds. Let me therefore briefly start just talking about the term of systemic risk. It's used in very different contexts and various definitions are generally employed. But I think the traditional definition of just looking at the failure of a systemic firm and then the repercussions it can have across a set of counterparties and ultimately the economy as a whole is probably too narrow. And I think what is equally important is that systemic risk can manifest itself through substantial volatility in asset prices and liquidity shocks, as we have seen in the recent crisis. So it is most important, really, to bring together these closely interlinked concepts and making sure that we really understand the feedback loops which are there and which can appear to get seemingly idiosyncratic micro risks and market disturbances brought together in a framework where actually it quickly emerges into a systemic crisis. So from my perspective, it's probably less important to spend lots of time around nomenclatura and definition, and various people have attempted to define what systemic risk is. I quite like, personally, the BIS, IMF, and FSB definition that talks about a systemic event as a risk of disruption to financial services that, first of all, is caused by impairment of all or parts of the financial system, and second, has the potential to have serious negative consequences for the real economy. I think that is as good a definition as any, really, of what we're talking about. In terms of what that means for us, clearly there's a lot of work already going on in the Financial Stability Board and in other international fora around these issues, and I know Masa is going to talk a bit more about some of that. But as Mario already said, it goes broader than the traditional prudential regulation and the focus on that. And that is particularly since the complexity of financial markets has made it much harder, to my mind, to have a clear distinction. It has really been blurring the different markets and different institutions, and has meant that monitoring systemic risk has become also extremely important for us as security regulators. In terms of what that means in practice, is that we need to be able to define potential sources and transmission mechanisms of systemic risk, detect those risks, and ultimately mitigate them. One potential area of further work here is identifying and measuring connectedness and co-movements of different markets. For that, securities regulators need enhanced access to information and need to make better use of it. They need to ultimately enhance their capabilities for risk analysis. We also need to improve the overall understanding of markets' vulnerabilities and the interconnections, and particularly the interconnections between the financial markets and the real economy. Developing and monitoring qualitative and quantitative indicators will require close coordination and effective communication between different individual institutions, but also in international fora. And I think IOSCO can help here by connecting different projects and different work streams, but also by pooling resources, because none of us at the moment really are fully able to comprehend how the global market and financial market hangs together. And also to exchange information and ideas, because ultimately this is also about making sure that we don't suffer again from a kind of groupthink, which gets us all walking in one direction while actually the risk is somewhere over there. Let me then practically talk about what we have been doing in IOSCO to try to shed a bit more light at one part of the financial system, at least for us to have a proper discussion around where the potential risks are. IOSCO has been working hard to develop a comparable global assessment of the hedge fund sector. There has been really a recent breakthrough in the fact that we have been able to, for the very first time, survey the hedge fund managers at a global level to try to find and get a view of what the overall impact of hedge funds on financial markets are. A global assessment of the sector is critically important because they are truly global players, and therefore every one of us individually doing it on a national basis will not have the same benefit as doing it collectively. So what has the work that IOSCO has done involved? First of all, we agreed a common set of questions and definitions that each of the task force members agreed to collect from hedge funds based in their jurisdictions. Or actually, I should be more correctly saying hedge fund managers are in their jurisdictions. Secondly, multiple jurisdictions have been running a survey from a common collection date, which was actually the 30th of September last year. And this was the first time, really, that many national regulators started collecting this type of statistic and information. Thirdly, those statistics were then reported up to the IOSCO secretariat on an aggregate and anonymous basis, because obviously people were quite nervous about identifying individual institutions. outside of the national regulator's own responsibilities. But it also involved a lot of liaison between different national authorities to reduce duplication of statistics. And finally, the IOSCO research unit has done a fantastic job trying to pull that information together. Let me briefly talk about the results of this analysis then that we will report to the Financial Stability Board in due course. The key conclusions are that, first of all, rather sadly but understandably, the coverage of what we have achieved this time around was quite limited because ultimately not all jurisdictions were able to yet conduct full surveys, either because they didn't have the facilities in place or because the legislation was not yet enabling them to do so. So the survey that we did overall only actually captured just under a third of the global net asset value. I think nonetheless there are a couple of key points which are worth drawing out from that analysis. The hedge fund industry in each jurisdiction remain clearly quite concentrated, with the top five managers holding a significant share of assets in each region. Secondly, the hedge funds captured in the survey have, on the whole, had a small aggregate footprint in most of the markets that we looked at. Thirdly, on average, hedge funds reported a strong ability to manage liquidity of their assets and liabilities at the current moment. However, I think we have to be careful with extrapolation from this because this is unlikely to hold necessarily true in very stressed market environments. Having said this was a very first attempt, I should also say that what we have done is learned quite a lot of valuable lessons from the exercise. So first of all, we have learned that we will need to improve further the type of information collected from hedge funds, and that will be a big exercise for the IOSCO members going forward. We will need to keep abreast of the work that is going on in different jurisdictions in terms of their attempts to collect similar type of statistics. In the US with Dodd-Frank, there will be a similar ability to collect data. In Europe with the AIFMD, again, data of this kind will be collected. And so it's very important that in IOSCO we try to help make sure that we try to get to at least as common a framework as we can so that we can truly compare the type of data that we collect and therefore draw real conclusions from it. Finally, the task force members need to agree a future date of repeating this type of survey to update the analysis and also to just start developing a time series so that you can actually see developments in the hedge fund sector and look at systemic risk and how it might be developing over time. So overall, this work has been extremely useful, I think, in us understanding the developments and tracking the risks of the hedge fund sector at a global level. And it's a good example of how securities regulators can actually look at systemic risk in a particular sector and help to draw conclusions, try to understand what the potential risks are, particularly in an area where actually the overall information in the public sector is still quite limited. Thank you.
Thank you, Verena. This work on the hedge fund industry is actually indeed extremely interesting. I come to think of it, I think we should, in the follow-up research, we should also try to identify whether or not Nobel Prize winners are involved in the management of these hedge funds, because those tend to be the riskiest. Saila.
Add that to the questionnaire.
Yes, I think we should. The more rocket science brain power, the more risky it gets. Saila, can I ask you to take the floor?
Thank you very much. Good afternoon. The presentation is up. Okay. I'd like to go through the key messages, given that it's getting late, to make sure that I get those across in the limited time we have. If we look at the financial structure, it has changed very dramatically in the last two decades. We now have a much more interconnected and concentrated financial sector. One of the issues that was raised earlier is what is the role of the securities regulators in monitoring and addressing systemic risks. And I think if we take a look at how interconnected the institutions, markets, products, and infrastructures has become, it's very obvious the very important role that systemic regulators play in monitoring and addressing such risks. And if you look at the financial sector, we basically have a handful of very large, complex financial institutions operating in a handful of global financial payments and settlement systems, and therefore the interconnectedness and concentration has actually grown very sharply. What that means is that we need to look at this issue of systemic risk or macroprudential regulation with a different focus, in the sense that systemic risk is not a new concept. As bank regulators know, systemic risk has been around for decades now. Especially for emerging markets, this has been an issue, and that's why you see a lot of the instruments that are now coming up as new, quote unquote, new instruments that were used by these institutions. But what we need now is a look at systemic risk in a much more, from the focus of markets, products, instruments, because we no longer have the traditional deposit-taking institutions which lend. We now have markets which intermediate, and that's why, in our view, it's very important to work together with IOSCO and other standard setters to bring these different aspects together, better map systemic risks, and also make sure that the institutional arrangements for what we now call macroprudential supervision include different types of regulators, different types of institutions and markets. But what concerns us at the fund is that this new focus on, now it's called macroprudential supervision, everyone is talking about macroprudential, that we don't forget microprudential supervision and regulation, because that's really key. If we don't get this right, we are not going to get macroprudential right either. So that means more effective and intrusive supervision, stronger cross-border arrangements to make sure that at the institutional level, at the market level, at the infrastructure level, we have these risks covered. What also this implies is that we need to accept shared responsibility, which was actually in the IOSCO, which was eloquently explained in the IOSCO report on systemic risk, between not only regulatory institutions, but we also heard about importance of judicial institutions, also Ministry of Finance, monetary authorities, because tax policies, monetary policies also affect incentives and therefore systemic risks. What I'd like to do is just go through a few charts. This is an interesting chart which shows in the last two decades how interconnectedness has increased so sharply. When we look at external assets and liabilities of countries, that has increased by sixfold. And what this graph shows is the index of bilateral links between economies as a share of all possible links, depending on their asset liability structures, and you see a very sharp increase. What we have done at the fund is we did a survey of about 65 countries plus the ECB, and the documents were circulated to the board, so I think they are already in our internet website, the main results of this survey, which shows that the institutions use qualitative as well as quantitative tools. And qualitative tools, of course, include active engagement with market participants, reviewing institution strategies and business plans, and analyzing trends and complexity in new products. Of course, it's not easy, as was mentioned, this requires a lot of resources, and you see that this is much less of an issue for some of the advanced countries than countries with less developed markets. Quantitative tools are also used in many countries. When you look at it, it's mainly systemic risk models or stress tests or single institution risk models that are used. What are also used are some qualitative methods, which are recent, which we call network analysis. We have done some work on this at the fund together with FSB and BIS colleagues as well. This one is one example from Chile. This is the interbank system on in January 2009. It's a complex web. When I first looked at these charts, I thought, what does this really tell us? It's, you know, so complex, and yes, they are linked. But it's actually very interesting. When you look at, I don't want to focus on one institution, but it's just that these charts show it. If you look at Santander, in January 2009, it's mainly linked to non-bank financial institutions and foreign banks. When you look at the same chart as of November 2009, just 8 months later, you see that it's now connected much more with the local institutions as well. So not only this gives you a better sense of how risks are changing, how exposures are changing between institutions, but also for microprudential supervision, what should the microprudential supervisor should concentrate on for its on-site inspections, for its reporting, and so on. In this same survey that I mentioned, there was a question about, there were several questions actually about the institutional setting in terms of how macroprudential or how systemic risk is monitored. Most of the countries, it's done through the central bank. Some of them are starting to establish financial stability committees, and then there are others which have different institutions leading the effort. What is key from the IMF perspective is that not necessarily a specific authority should be in charge. We think that it should very much depend on the conditions in each country, depending on their markets, the depth of their markets, the way the institutions are set up, and so on. But the key is that there should be an authority with clear powers in terms of information collection, reporting, and a clear framework for governance and accountability, and a formal mechanism of coordination, because there's clearly different institutions responsible for different policies, which at the end affect the incentives for risk-taking and therefore systemic risk. I'm not going to go into this chart. I think probably it's hard to read. It shows different indicators that are used by countries, such as size, complexity, interconnectedness, the cross-sectoral dimension of systemic risk, but also time dimension, procyclicality, credit growth, asset price inflation, which is more, if you like, over time changes. Leverage, liquidity risk, currency risks, as well as capital flows. When you look at the choice of instruments, the key issues, of course, are how effective they are, what type of instruments can you use to minimize regulatory arbitrage, how to make sure that they are as little distortionary as possible, and also a lot of these instruments are costly, and if you put them in a cumulative way, they are actually very costly for the industry, which goes back then the implications on the real sector, on the real economy, and those all have to be evaluated carefully before coming up with new tools and new policies. So when, this is my last slide. What is really key, as I mentioned at the start, is to not become complacent about the importance of micro-supervision. We have done many FSAPs in countries. It has now become this is the Financial Stability Assessment Program that the IMF and the World Bank coordinate on. We work with experts to look at countries' compliance with different regulations and international standards, including, of course, IOSCO's principles. What comes out from these FSAPs we have done, and we will have a board paper ready by the summer on this, is basically the need for more intrusive on-site inspections, so more frequent inspections and depth of work and resources allowed, not only for the largest institutions, but also for some of the smaller and medium-sized institutions to make sure that the risks are not in what we call shadows or those that are not as regulated as some of the largest institutions, what we now call systemically important financial institutions. Second issue, which again was quoted in the IOSCO report, and Verin also mentioned it, comes out very clearly from the FSAPs, is the need for better reporting requirements. Currently there are gaps on what we call unregulated entities, but also in terms of the granularity and the frequency of the information on regulated entities. And finally, proactive enforcement comes as one of the key issues that more work needs to be done in terms of relying either on moral suasion or third parties in conducting supervision, which of course works for many countries, but again, at the same time, may be not very good in terms of monitoring systemic risk. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Sheila, for this interesting analysis. It's quite reassuring that after these very complex diagrams that you showed, that at least your conclusions were very down to earth and simple language that we simple regulators can understand. So thank you for that. Massa,
yes.
What are you going to tell us?
So first of all, my great pleasure and honor to be here. Excuse me for my sore throat. The weather was too good actually yesterday and the day before. I promise to be provocative, so I will try to be. But first of all, I should mention that maybe unlike most people in this room, I have spent most of my career being a bank regulator, that is a prudential regulator, with some years of stints in market regulation and insurance supervision. So what I can tell from my experience is that if a prudential regulator ever comes to you and says to you, well, we know so much about systemic risk and maybe you shouldn't worry about it, or at least we have those wonderful thoughts to contain systemic risks, now maybe you should do the same, your answer should be, well, thank you very much for your advice, but we won't believe you. And those are the people who failed, and I'm talking about myself, so this is indeed one thing that I can tell from my experience, that there are no magic answers or solutions. We just have to think hard about those risks that we have identified. We even added a few just now. I do have some slides here. I won't go through each and every one of them. I also sit in the Financial Stability Board, and therefore sometimes I will have to defend the FSB, even though if you might not like it. But let's say at the FSB, of course, we have had strong orders from the summit meetings, and we're now working very hard on the question of SIFIs, and SIFIs being systemically important financial institutions. But the focus up to now has been on banks. And although the work process and the timelines are established already for completion in 2011 and beyond, basically for non-bank SIFIs, we don't yet have an agreed timetable nor a real process for dealing with that. In the FSB report, with some recommendations for dealing with SIFIs, particularly G-SIFIs, but with this focus on banking, we have this list of measures that we are considering, but there is still a very strong focus on bank capital. Now, I'm not going to say that bank capital is unimportant, but actually, through my career again, I had the Japanese financial crisis, which was once in 50 or 100 years, the global financial crisis, once in 100 to 200 years, and then I have the recent earthquake and tsunami that was supposed to happen in once in every 1,000 years. And we have some lessons to learn from that. I will mention, come back to that shortly. But with this focus on capital, that is maybe necessary, but absolutely incomplete, or it is not not the answer to all of the problems that we may be encountering. And this brings me back to the earthquake and tsunami, because there is a tale of two villages. One village had a high seawall in front of the village. Those people thought that, of course, this seawall will protect them from a tsunami that will come every century, let's say. The other village did not have the seawall, but they believed the ancestors' old sayings that they should not build their houses below a certain point on this hill. And they observed this. This teaching was really engraved in a stone that dates back to several centuries ago. Now, in this village that had a seawall, unfortunately, most people had everything washed away, and tremendous numbers of lives were lost. In this other village, everyone was saved. There was no deaths. I mean, of course, maybe some ships were taken by the tsunami, but at least no lives were lost. The reason why, of course, if you have this seawall, you become complacent. You take on risks, and without even thinking that you're taking risks. And that brings me to this lesson that we have to learn from this, is that building a seawall is like building a buffer of capital. A capital will protect you to a certain point, but it is not almighty. I think our real focus should be on de-risking, or to reduce the risks, and also to manage a crisis, how to manage it. Now, I should move forward. I have here an example of CCPs, and this is just to say that CCPs are different from other types of institutions, particularly they're different from banks in a certain sense, and that we cannot deal with CCPs in the same manner as we treat banks. Possible candidates for non-bank CCPs, it's a long list, but here again, you see so many diverse entities, investment banks, CCPs, other FMIs, securities exchanges, hedge funds that we just talked about. All these are so different, so we will not have a one-size-fits-all solution. Well, what can capital market regulators do? We heard from Mario, we had a very long list of measures that can be taken. In the case of CCPs, we are starting to discuss such measures. Not CCPs exactly, but with OTC derivatives, we are thinking about those measures. But let's say, from what I just mentioned, policy measures may differ, I wrote, but will differ according to the type of non-bank SIFI. FMIs, those financial market infrastructures, cannot be allowed to fail without properly ensuring continuity of essential clearing and settlement functions or trading facilities. Now, would you even allow them to fail is a fundamental question. And for banks, I think we've already come over this, that we should be able to resolve a bank. But I'm not sure whether we can really resolve a CCP. I mean, I would like to hear views from the floor on this. But what I can clearly say is that there are those CFIs, non-bank CFIs, that can be dealt with in a way maybe similar to bank CFIs, but that is only a small portion of the long list. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Masa. I must say that I'm not always a firm believer in the resilience of markets, but after hearing you again, I'm a firm believer in the resilience of the Japanese people after the disaster that have struck Japan. I'm at a loss what to do now. We have not so much time left. Could I ask you if there are urgent points that you would like to react to one another? And if so, let's do that now, and then we'll turn to the audience for questions as quickly as possible. Yeah. could ask the audience that after these four very interesting introductions, if there are any questions to the panel. Yes, please, over there.
Thank you. Gottfried de Witz from ICAP, Director of European Affairs. To Masso, I keep hearing this, that trade repositories are systemically important non-CIFIs. Now, a trade repository is, of course, for the use of regulators to know where the positions are and how quick they accumulate. But even if a trade repository doesn't stop functioning or stops functioning one day, it's not going to create systemic risk, is it? So I'm confused.
The question is, are trade repositories, do they constitute a CIFI? I would guess not. I mean, it is a tool, it is indeed a tool for regulators, but in the, unlike CCPs, which are very important to contain a counterparty risk, but which can in themselves become a huge risk, I don't think that anybody would say that trade repositories are should be considered CIFIs.
I suppose the question you could ask is whether complete blindness of the regulator to where the kind of trades are going on, whether that constitutes, it doesn't constitute a systemic risk, but it probably you wouldn't want it to continue forever.
Yes, I think we have learned our lessons in the recent past here. Before, I see another question there. Please, go ahead.
First of all, I'd like to thank the panel for a very informative discussion on this very important topic on systemic risk. I'm Nehal Vora from the Bombay Stock Exchange, India. My question to the panel is that most regulators have obligation to develop markets on one hand, and now with systemic risk, especially after the financial turmoil, has been thrust upon most regulators. So there apparently seems to be a conflict that when the regulators are in the process of developing a framework on how systemic risk should be measured and probably rectified, would that really have a bearing on the innovation on the products which are permitted by regulators? Because there is no firm way of really finding out how systemic risk for a new product should really be basically identified.
Should new products be tested on CIFIness before they are being produced? It is a good question.
Yep.
Which I think our tendency is always to say no, because we can't do it. So, but the consequence is waiting for the problems to erupt, like in the securitization process, is of course not very good. Masa.
If I may, again, talking from my past sins or deeds, we tried to do that very long time ago in our country to control those new products. And let's say a very onerous approval process for new products were sometimes introduced. In some cases, it was not so obvious, but the authorities were able to frown upon certain products. But what that caused was actually a certain movement towards regulatory arbitrage. That is, new products came up again, which were probably designed from a risk management point of view in the same manner, but had a totally different legal arrangement or legal framework that, of course, enabled this institution to market it without our approval. So, I would say that it will be probably impossible, really, for a regulator to preempt such products. And if it tries to do so, it will even have unintended consequences of regulatory arbitrage.
Verena?
I think you point to a very important point at Masa as well, to this kind of balance between innovation on the one hand and on the other hand, making sure that you don't create kind of non-understood risks. But I think to my mind, it is similarly to Maz's point, it is not about necessarily saying, you know, you can't do this unless we've given you explicit permission. It is about a dialogue as well between the regulators and the industry to really understand what the potential implications of these new products might be, and then to put something in place that actually allows you to get a feel for how they develop and what the potential implications of it are. So, for example, in the retail space, I mean, understanding who they're sold to by whom and what the kind of complaint rate, for example, is that is coming out, and trying to then preemptively deal with that and not let it grow into a massive problem, but try to contain it as a small problem if, for whatever reason, that new innovative product doesn't quite have the effects you desired.
Shayla, you?
Yeah, I just wanted to add, compliment the response in the sense that one shouldn't only look at the product, but also the investor base to better understand who, like Verena said, who will be investing in the product and what that means, what are the needs of that investor base. And what comes out in terms of the analysis that we have done is we always think of these issues in silos, that we don't necessarily think about what are the different legal, accounting, regulatory changes that affect the investor base. For example, we are now talking about Basel III, we're talking about Solvency II, there are accounting, major accounting changes, legal issues. But I don't know if we take a cumulative analysis and understanding of how these different changes interact and what it means for development on one hand, innovation, financial sophistication on the other hand. And I think we need to do more work on these issues.
Mario.
Well, I agree with my colleague. I think the approach of approving products, I think, is not really desirable. I think the challenge for a regulator is to understand the products, that, as my colleague said, I think to well understand the consequences and what impact they may have on the markets. So I think that it's more a monitoring approach and an understanding approach of the product that should be followed by regulators.
What I still find the most amazing phenomenon during and preceding the crisis is that the total collapse of business standards, underwriting standards that preceded the crisis in the formation of these securitizations with, you know, 50% of the raw material of these securitizations at a certain point were liar loans. And that could all go on for about 2-3 years under our very noses, and that nothing happened. And what I find also very curious in the aftermath is that while we now we know exactly what has gone on, that there seems to be so little enforcement for also from our side, and which really makes me wonder if our conduct of business legal framework is strong enough to really enforce aggressively against these massive breaches of conduct of business. Is that something that you recognize? Massa?
Well, I think we do. And in fact, except for some insurance products, we do no longer exercise product approval in advance. But we also at the same time find it more important to monitor developments and also be able to identify cases where business conduct is really in the realm of either deception or fraudulous or whatever that those general principles could be in breach. It would be ideal, of course, if we had more precise rules on what business conduct would constitute either an enforceable breach of rules, and in some cases we do have such rules, of course, but maybe you need also a certain principles type approach where you can say that whatever the form that product takes, this certainly is a deceptive way of marketing it, for example.
Totally agree with you there, Massa. More questions? Yes, please, go ahead.
Daniel Trinder from Deutsche Bank. The panel talked about coordination between regulators in the collection of data, etc. At the same time, there's a lot of initiatives to improve the data on short selling, on hedge funds, etc. But do you think you've got the technology to actually analyze and collect the data within your own regulatory authorities? Because I just don't think there's been a debate about the use of technology within regulatory authorities. If a bank such as Deutsche Bank wants to try and monitor the risks internally, it's about technology spend to try and monitor the risks. I just welcome any thoughts you have about the type of IT budgets you've got and whether you feel, given the responsibilities you're going to have going forward and the issues, whether there's enough there.
Could you please repeat that question to our ministers of finance? Because I think we all recognize this question. And you know, for example, if I just talk about my own institution, do we have the technology to monitor properly high frequency trading? I don't think so. So there are some really big risks there. But Verena, would you like to react to this?
Yes, it's one of our biggest challenges. I think it is both about, you know, being clear about what data do we actually need. And I think you need to be careful there as well, because just being swamped by more and more data isn't necessarily going to be the answer either. You need to make sure that you get the right data as far as you can judge it. And then you need to have systems that allow you to properly analyze and process that. But also you need some people who actually take whatever this business analysis then gives you and can actually draw some conclusions from that. So I think it's a kind of multi-tiered issue which I think we face both at national level and I will be facing in the European context, because it becomes even more complex once you try to do it across different countries.
Mario?
I think we're not... I can speak for my case. I think we're not even at the technology level. I think we're at the level of finding the person that can develop the system and comprehend the products and set up the process. And even that is a challenge because the resources are rare. Products are sophisticated to get the person that have the brain power to do that job is already a challenge. So. I think there's a long way to go in that direction for regulators. I think the intention is good, but as Verena said, I mean, we may be swamped under a lot of data, and at the end, it's almost a risk because you have this confidence that you have information, but you're not doing much with it.
Personally, I think that there is almost no way for regulators to catch up with the business practices of the private sector. And that is why I think we have to pay maximum attention to prevention. And there I differ a little bit with Massa. I think not so much this wall should be so high, but I think, you know, when we have a financial system in which banks still have only, even after Basel III, only have about 10% of the capital that a normal company has, it's still asking for trouble. And so we should probably be going back to buffers that were normal before the Second World War, when crisis also happened, but were a lot less frequent than they are now. I think we have time for a final question.
Hello.
Yes, please.
Howard Wong from Taiwan. My question is, the Dodd-Frank Act has been passed last year, and it seems like most of the topic we are talking about today, I mean, meaning systematic risk, credit rating agency, OTC derivative, all this, I think Dodd-Frank is actually the first one to realize all the principle into the regulations. So I would like to ask for each of the panelists, how will you think the Dodd-Frank will affect the future, let's say, policy or recommendation from IOSCO or the SFB?
Mario.
Well, I have no great insight on that. I think that's the reverse. It's the FSB should affect Dodd-Frank, but I don't know what, I don't have no great insight on that. That's very.
I think what is happening at the moment is that different jurisdictions are progressing on dealing with similar issues at slightly different timetables, and in a way that's inevitable because we each have national governments who have different views of when they start. Dodd-Frank was obviously a very comprehensive view across the different issues and a comprehensive response, which, you know, other jurisdictions are looking at, and I think it is an important contribution. I think one of the things I always have seen IOSCO as contributing is actually trying to, where possible, set, you know, high-level principles that then national governments and regulators could try to fit within so that we get reasonably consistent outcomes globally. And I think that is still something which IOSCO needs to continue to do. And I think the Dodd-Frank is just one of the examples of the national responses that are coming through.
Just Sailor?
Yeah, a few words. Also agreed that Dodd-Frank has moved the frontier, but on its own, it's not going to be effective. As we know, a lot of these institutions are working cross-border. So unless you get cross-border collaboration, the supervisory colleges working much better, the resolution working much better, you're not going to go very far just with national, even though it may be the best legislation, it's not going to get us very far as the global financial system. And therefore, there is a very important role for FSB, IOSCO, and other standard setters to make sure that these legislative frameworks are to some degree harmonized and coordinated across borders, because otherwise we're just going to see the next crisis, which will be, let's say, a CCP, which Dodd-Frank alone is not going to be able to deal with.
Masa?
Well, actually, I have nothing to add to my colleagues, except that we are on this very happy note that IOSCO is so important in this context.
Well, I think that this panel has made clear that we are indeed looking at systemic risk these days as securities regulators, and that we are looking at a wide range of institutions and possible risks. And I think the biggest risk of this all is that we start looking at too many things, and that we start confusing the big picture with detail. And there are a lot of people in the markets who would like to abuse this. Don't look at us, look at the others. Don't look at the banks, look at the hedge funds. Look at speculation in commodity markets. And the biggest trap that is there for us is that we lose sight of the simple things. But I can assure you, we will not. Thank you for being here. I thank the panel, Mario, Verena, Sela, and Masa. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Hans, I feel a little bit like Santa Claus walking around with us. Ladies and gentlemen, we just want to, as a token of our appreciation, hand over gifts to Professor Golden. Thank you so much for those introductory comments. If you would please join us on stage, Professor. Let's give him a round of applause, ladies and gentlemen.
Thank you so much. Thank you very much for joining us.
And then, Hans, if you would like to hand over to your panel. Ladies and gentlemen, I think we've all learned a lot from our panel, and let's give all of them a huge round of applause. Thank you so much.
Mario. Mario, thank you.
And thank
so
you
much.
Very much to Hans, of course, for very, very ably chairing that. So thank you. Let's give him a round of applause too. Ladies and gentlemen, I would now like to remind you that, of course, we have very generous sponsors, and we want to say a big thank you to them for making this whole event possible. Our sponsors, of course, ASISA, the Johannesburg Stock Exchange, Strait, Investec, and ICAP. So a big thank you to all our sponsors. Let's give our sponsors a huge round of applause. Thank you so much for their generosity. Now, ladies, also, I would like to mention that tonight is formal. Ladies and gentlemen, it's a formal event. So please do note the gala dinner is on the ground floor. Dinner is in Hall 4A. And from 7 until 7:30, the buses will collect you from the various conference hotels. The only conference hotel the bus won't collect from is the Western, because it's literally a couple of meters across that you have to walk. So, ladies and gentlemen, the buses will collect between 7 and 7:30. Also, there are the Ibu Yambo CDs. That was the band that played on the first night. We had quite a number of requests. If you would like to buy their CDs, we'll make sure that they are available. Just inquire. They're available at 150 rand, so that's approximately 15 euros. So if you would like to take home that as a souvenir, of course, SA Gifts do have more gifts for you if you are looking at that. Ladies and gentlemen, also our panel discussion, panel 4 for tomorrow, Jeff Van Rooyen has asked if the panel would please meet in front just after this, just to formalize and finalize tomorrow's panel. From my side, thank you so much for joining us for this, also the first panel discussion, and we look forward to 3 more panel discussions tomorrow. So thank you for your great questions, ladies and gentlemen, and I look forward to seeing you at the gala dinner this evening. Enjoy. Thank you so much. Good afternoon. Ladies and gentlemen, I've also been asked panel 3, if you would please join us in front as well, just to finalize some formalities. And for that matter, panel 2, I'm not sure if any of the representatives are here, but I think perhaps you want to come down to just to find out about the technicalities of the panel discussions. So all our panels, if you would, please meet in front.